I'm going to say this at the top. I love ballet. I fell in love with it when I was 9, and like anything you love over 30 years, there have been ups and downs. But I want you to know, I'm not here because I want to burn it down. I'm here because I think it needs a bit of a renovation in some areas. It seems ballet is often in the headlines these days as it wrestles itself into the 21st century. Whether it's point shoe manufacturers getting more inclusive with their color ranges, the lack of female choreographers, or a director fired for, well, just do an online search and you'll see some pretty shameful examples. In this Movers, Shakers, Makers miniseries, Ballet for the 21st Century, we're going to talk about three topics that have bubbled to the surface recently. That's not to say people haven't been calling for change before now, but the recent social justice movements have lit a fire under that call for reform. In this miniseries, we'll be investigating each topic, interviewing experts and dancers, and putting forward some constructive suggestions. Today we present Ballet for the 21st Century, Ballet and Mental Health, The Survey. Hi listeners, this is part 2 of our Ballet and Mental Health episode. You might like to go back and listen to part 1 if you haven't already. It's up now. In it, we go over what we did with a survey that was taken by over 400 professionally trained dancers and interview some great dancers about their responses to it. In this section, we're going to discuss the results with a professional therapist, that is. Terry Hyde is a retired ballet dancer himself. He danced with English National Ballet and the Royal Ballet and has been a psychotherapist and counselor since 2010. He has diplomas in counseling from the Open University, Wealden Psychology Institute, Middlesex University, and is a registered member of the British Association for Counseling and Psychotherapy. At the end of the episode today, we're going to put forward some takeaways based on the survey and all the feedback comments we've received, so make sure you stay to the end. Before our conversation, Terry had done the survey himself, so I started by asking him what his reaction was to the questions as an ex-dancer.
Well, Emma, I think I was really lucky in the respect that I had a very good training. There was no real bullying pressure or body shaming or anything like that right the way through. And even in my professional career as a dancer, it didn't seem, I seemed to just sort of plow through things. I think it was a sort of the initial training of get on with it. But I realize now get on with it and push through your pain and all that is not a good idea. Because it just shortens dancers' careers, and it also puts pressure on the dancer to perform, as in not perform as in on stage, but to perform all the time. And you know, from a mental health aspect, it's too much stress.
So the survey was split into two sections, school and professional life, with many questions repeating in either side. Some of the variations are interesting between school and professional life, and sometimes the consistency between the two is also interesting. But in terms of, there was a multiple choice for depression and panic attack symptoms, and I'll just name them. So daily apprehension, walking into school or a company, negative obsessive thoughts, insomnia, extreme sadness, feelings of worthlessness, intense fear, extreme fatigue, intense feelings of hopelessness, and then right down to panic attacks. 90% ticked one or multiple of these in both school and professional life. And in fact, it went up slightly in professional life. What's your reaction to that?
Well, from my point of view as a psychotherapist, these are triggers create. So what you've listed is symptoms, but symptoms are created by triggers. So triggers will come from, more often than not, from childhood, unless there's been a traumatic event in teen or young adult life. The triggers will then be created then, but more often than not, it's from childhood. So whether it's environment, as in the family, or in training as well. So if unfortunately you had a teacher who was rather oppressive and would body shame or would shame you in front of the other class, those are the triggers that are then set into the unconscious. And from that, then anything else, so it's not feeling good enough. And you know, as dancers, we are trained in a way that is very black and white. If you're not doing it the way that the teacher said, then you're wrong. Mm. And being corrected all the time, some people take that as not being good enough. And so that becomes part of their psyche. And moving forward, they will always feel not good enough until they reframe things. And that's a part of the workshops that I do, also part in my therapy sessions. So it is changing a mindset, changing the way that you think you were taught. So maybe teachers were being supportive, but a child can also, the perspective is, I'm being got at, or I'm not good enough, you know, because I'm being corrected all the time, I'm not good enough. And so that just carries on through. So I hope that answers your questions. What you've listed are symptoms.
Yeah.
What creates or triggers.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good distinction to make. And I do think it's also good that you point out there's, you know, there's a complex combination of things involving like home life, genetics that could make someone prone to being depressed or open to panic attacks. And as you say, like the symptoms that we collected were from personal experience of a friend group and also a little bit of research. But if you were, let's say, a dance teacher or someone in a ballet class and you were observing another, let's take it to student, what would be some of the outward signs of a depression or a panic attack? What would that look like?
It's not obvious in a lot of occasions. Some of the symptoms. A panic attack is obvious because the panic attack will actually freeze the person. They cannot go on and they'll run out of class, perhaps in tears. Mm. It's the breathing is the first thing. Mm. So heightened breathing. The heart rate goes, a teacher wouldn't notice it. Another student or another dance colleague wouldn't notice it's going on until it becomes severe. And they'll either collapse or just leaning against the bar, leaning against the wall and have that pant. But we are, as performers, we wear a mask all the time. I mean, in general, public people wear masks. I don't mean COVID masks. emotional masks that we hide the true self. So we create different personas in different circumstances. And in class, we are taught from an early age to look front, look, you know, and when you're looking side and all of those sort of things, but with no smiling faces unless you're actually performing or doing something in the center, do some center work. And so this sort of serious look is our mask. And so that hides a lot of emotions that's going on. You don't want to show your teacher that you're injured by twinging in your face. At a pain or something like that. You see, that shows weakness. And of course, you don't want to show weakness. So there's this incredible mask that dancers have not to show injury weakness. And of course, they won't then show emotional and mental health issues because that's a sign of weakness as well.
In fact, then sometimes on top of that, we're then asked to act a character or smile or whatever. So it's almost a mask on a mask. there's many layers to it.
Yes, you're right.
Can you just briefly, for the layman, help me connect depression and a panic or anxiety attack? Do they always go hand in hand, or are there symptoms in common?
No, not really, because panic and anxiety come from the fight and flight mode, except unless it's a real trauma that's happened, attacked in the street or something like that, or have seen a car accident right in front of you or been in a car accident, that is a true fight and flight mode. That's a real thing. But general anxiety disorder, panic attacks, are not real. They're created by a thought. I'm talking generally now. I mean, I might be picked up on this by some of your listeners, but generally speaking, our anxiety, which then creates a panic attack, is not real. It's not real at all. It's a thought. So you go into thoughts of what if. That's the usual trigger. What if my shoe fell off? What if I forgot the choreography? What if I crash into the scenery. All of these sort of things. What if the teacher sees that I've got an injury? You know, that can create anxiety and a panic attack. The panic attack usually happens after some traumas or perceived traumas early on in your life, or even the previous week. Depression, on the other hand, would normally, again, I'm generally speaking here, would normally happen after a traumatic event. Someone in the family being diagnosed with cancer, for instance. And then the person goes through the what ifs and then feels low about it. So rather than becoming anxious, they start feeling low. They sleep less at night, but maybe sleep more during the day, so they don't want to get up. There's different symptoms to it. Now, if someone has a general anxiety disorder that's chronic, in other words, it's gone for more than 6 months, they're more likely to get depression because they're in a state of panic all the time. They're in a state of anxiety, and it gets on top of you. Things that get on top of you then create the depression.
Yeah. Another aspect of mental health that really stood out for me in the survey, and I'm sure we're going to start seeing that a lot of these are holding hands, was eating distress and body image issues. And, you know, this is quite famous in ballet. I think if you, anyone on the street, if you ask them about dancers, they've probably seen Black Swan and they think that we're all bulimic or something. But I think there's a little bit more nuance to eating distress that can take over your life. In the survey, we listed guilt after eating, restricted calorie intake, purging, obsessive thoughts about weight, obsessive eating habits, binge eating, extreme negative thoughts about body shape. So we actually had only 20% of the survey takers said they didn't suffer from any of these. And that is right the way through school into professional life. And even gender, men reporting slightly less as students. But this is obviously a massive issue. I know that eating disorders are one of the hardest to treat of mental disorders. How do we even start to unpick this in ballet, where you are stood in front of a mirror in tights and a leotard all day looking and trying to perfect your body? Because these numbers are terrible.
There needs to be a universal shift away from the inverted commas perfect dancer's body. The nymph look, as one author wrote about it, it is inhuman to have to sustain something that is unsustainable necessarily. Now, there's a lot of nutritionists, dietitians nowadays that are dealing with that in the respect of nutritional value of what to eat. But what it needs to come down is wiping away that look that is needed, that artistic directors or principals, I know, let's go to artistic directors, that artistic directors want. They need to realize it's inhuman to sustain something like that. From that, the principals of the pre-professional, the vocational schools need to realize exactly the same thing, but they're just playing into the hands of the artistic directors. So there's a whole knock-on effect. Yeah. And so someone, and it's happening now, it's the a resurgence of dancers saying, no, this has got to stop. To be able to have this knock-on effect from bottom up and top down. So there are artistic directors now, newer ones coming in that have probably gone through something like body dysmorphia, etc., or an eating disorder, even if it's male or female, that are saying this has got to stop. And so all different shapes and sizes, as long as their talent is acceptable to the school, then they will take them. And it's brilliant. There are a couple of big schools in the UK that are doing this. And these are with these new thinking principles. But the dance companies need to have the same new feel, new look of about this, because all the artistic directors is thinking, this is the look that I want, and this is the look that I'm going to get. So from that point of view, then all the others become rejects. And I'd call them bullies.
Yeah,
I'd really call them bullies if they have that fixed mindset. So they need to be called out, those ones. The media obviously are liking it because it's big news for them. Yeah. And so it really is abuse.
You know, the next generation of people who are going to be the artistic directors, who in your thesis are the kind of center point of all of this, where the rest of the attitudes are kind of radiating from their being tastemakers, the gatekeepers. I do think it's heartening that the next generation are maybe more my age, probably went through school in a time when things were improving slightly, or at least were more aware of mental health problems, had the language, had the tools. And like you said, hopefully they are making changes. The bullying aspect was the other thing that really jumped out in the survey for me. And it's hard to pinpoint exactly what a bully might look like as an authority figure. But if I just narrow it down to something you've spoken about, like the language that's used. So 80% of students and about 70% of professionals say they've been subjected to or witnessed some kind of verbal abuse. And I characterize this as bad, like foul language in class, yelling in anger, comments that might have made the person feel uncomfortable or make them feel, bad about themselves personally. This kind of interaction has to change. How did this get so normalized? And I know that's a big question for you, but how did we accept being yelled at as children and then later on being yelled at like children as adults in ballet? Because if you walked into an office, most offices, just down the street, I don't know, they sell paper. If you went in there and you had the boss like yelling at one of the employees and telling them they need to like fix their hair and lose some weight, I mean, it would be unacceptable.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But you see, the thing is, there's the old school, in inverted commas. And until the old school is cleared out, then it will carry on. And it needs the students' parents, and the dancers in the professional companies to actually call out the bullies and say, this cannot go on. You can't treat me. You can't speak to us the way that you do. Unfortunately, there is a board of directors or a board of trustees, and they may have this sort of rose-tinted look. And I'm generalizing here, a rose-tinted look at this glamorous artistic director or principal. That brings the history of what he or she has danced and all these different companies, et cetera, et cetera. To me, that doesn't matter what their history is. It's how the behavior is now, in the here and now. If you cannot treat another human being in a humane way, then you shouldn't be in a position of authority and trust. See, this is it. People trust them when they are not trustworthy. And a lot of them have very strong narcissistic traits, which, of course, one of the traits of a narcissist is no empathy. They don't care about other people, other humans. And so when you look at those in positions of trust, they need empathy. They need to understand. Mm. So as I said, you've got these new people coming in that have been treated badly and will say in their heads, I'm never going to treat anyone like that ever. Yeah. And you also get some old school people who have mentors of a different way of thinking, a more positive, a more nurturing and supportive way that says, you can't treat people like that anymore. If you want them to perform, if you want them to improve, if you want to lengthen their careers, you need to support them. They then change because they see the light, as it were.
What you're saying absolutely bears out what I found, which this is my one massive surprise in the survey, is I broke it down into age. And people who graduated pre-1995 were overwhelmingly more positive about their experience through school and company. So they reported fewer instances of eating disorders, fewer instances of panic attacks, verbal abuse, even though they admitted they didn't have much mental health support, even though they admitted they didn't feel they had much of a voice. They were overwhelmingly much more positive about their schooling and career. And if you compare that to the youngest cohort, so who graduated in the last 5 years, they were overwhelmingly the most negative. And that blew my mind because I thought the younger ones would be doing much better because I thought things were improving. But actually what you're saying is it's the old guard who graduated, you know, pre-95. Those are the ones who are teaching the people right now. And maybe that bears out. They don't see anything wrong with what happened in their training. That's just the way it was. You know, that's it's always been done like this. It works. Why do we need to change it now? So it bears out that if they are the ones in charge now, that the younger generation, especially now when attitudes are changing towards mental health and people are encouraged to speak out a bit more, they're more aware of it. I'd like to take a moment to talk about some of the dancers who would have trained professionally in a vocational school or conservatory and who went a different way when they graduated or perhaps they didn't graduate. They were very difficult comments to read from that group who left. There was a lot of anxiety issues still there. There were, you know, well, I'll read one quote. A survey taker said, "I have regular nightmares of being back at training, suffering verbal abuse. Anxiety is now a part of my daily life. I feel as though I will never have a healthy relationship with my body and food." And this is just one of many, many, many. I should also say for balance that people mentioned some positives from being trained as a professional dancer, that they were tough. They ended up very disciplined, resourceful. And we all know that you're going to have an excellent work ethic if you've been a professional dancer.
Yes, definitely.
And as you say, a lot of them, you know, they feel like they've been rejected or failed. I feel like there's a little void left here that needs to be filled in terms of the aftercare of people who either leave training and don't go on to professional career, or indeed, you know, if their professional career, if they feel as though it's cut short. Do you have any advice for people who are feeling this way, having left dance?
Yes. You need to go to therapy. And obviously a therapist that knows dancers or knows athletes at least. And I think there's not many of us around. So what's going on for them is that if they have had severe trauma or perceived trauma during their training or during their professional career, then there is it's a mild PTSD, because right. that the person that you read out their feedback was suffering from mild PTSD because they kept getting triggered, kept getting nightmares, and that's what PTSD is, post-traumatic stress disorder. So there's also a loss of identity. So if you think of a policeman, for instance, so they start training at age 21, and they retire at 50, I think, or 55, something like that. So they have the 30 years there, but that's from age 20. We as dancers started training, let's say, from 5 years old. So they've been in that regime up to age 20. So that's 15 years already. So that is that's their identity, in the same way that the police is an identity. And so any career that is cut short is always going to be a loss of identity. And with a loss of identity or even a transition, there's going to be a grieving process. It's a bereavement. It's a loss. I'll tell you, I will disclose, and I think there's many people that have already heard me say this anyway, I had to give up performing for family reasons. And when I trained as a psychotherapist, part of the training was that we had to have 4 years of weekly therapy ourselves.
Wow.
And it wasn't until I was going through that did I realize that I had a number of years when I retired that I was going through grieving. I didn't realize it, and I hadn't grieved properly. And so at the point, like 15, 20 years later, I started grieving then the loss of my career, my identity. And so understanding what we suppress throughout our life was very helpful to me to understand the process that I went through myself. Because what I did, and you mentioned it in the abilities of a dancer, I said, okay, I've got to give up. I've got to do what I have to do with the family. I then set up a business and I just plowed on throughout life. And it was only until all those years later did I realize when I was going through that therapy that I actually hadn't stopped.
It's incredible that you would have been carrying this for decades and not have had the time or the awareness to see how it was affecting your life. A lot of the survey takers who left dance for one reason or another, they mentioned difficulty in their, I'll use quotation marks, civilian lives with bosses at work. Some of them are brilliant with authority. Some of them really bridle at authority. A lot of people have linked it to their training. I'd say at least two people said that their romantic relationships were affected by the power dynamics in dance training. I am not a psychoanalyst, but does that make sense to you that it would affect your day-to-day civilian relationships?
Oh, certainly, yes, because the triggers don't necessarily have to be the whole person. It could be the way they speak to another individual, the tone of voice, the words that they use, the way that they look. All of these things can create a trigger in somebody, so they don't know what's happening. So triggers are all unconscious. You've moved on, but what you're doing is you're carrying all of that past with you. Even though people say, oh, I've dealt with it, I put it in a box, but I say to them, how heavy is that box now that you're pulling along with you? You know, people compartmentalize things, and they don't need to take the stuff out of the box, rationalize it in the here and now, and then that will then empty that box and you can throw the box away.
It's obvious that there are structures of power that lead to abuse that we don't just see in dance. Let's be fair, you know, like gymnastics, famously the film industry recently, and I'm sad to say the church as well. So these are places that are involving young people and authority figures who have a tremendous amount of power over them. There are some very dark examples of what can happen at the extremes of this, including ballet. And I really don't want to paint all schools and companies in the same brush. But I think if you just take a snapshot of the dance world in the last couple of years, you know, there's some horrendous things that have come to light. And frankly, if there are only like two solid examples, that is too many, you know, at the really bad end of the scale of this. We're talking like severe mental and physical sexual abuse. I think that all schools and all companies, all independent projects need to take steps to safeguard against these things, even if they don't think it applies to them, you know, like make it impossible to apply to you and your organization. So having said that, can you tell me about some of the things that are in place that you're aware of in schools and institutions that are tackling these issues?
Yes, there's open forums, as in the students have a group and they represent all the students. So word gets to the students then talk to the principal or the well-being officer in the school, and they feel supported. You see, if people don't feel supported and listened to, they say, oh, I won't bother. You know, why bother talking to them if nothing is done? So that sort of communication needs to be in every school to be able to listen and support. I mean, I know of a couple of vocational colleges that a tyrant runs them, who will just tell the students to get on with it, and it's in their imagination, and this isn't happening. So it's not going to go any further. And the tyrants usually have a board of directors or a board of trustees, which is what I mentioned earlier, that's in their pocket. And so even if they went to the board of directors or the board of trustees, they would get nothing, because the board of trustees would then question the tyrant, and they say, no, nothing's happening. No, we're all right. So then the students or the parents need to go to the media. So that's the process that needs to be done. But it's really good to see that some schools have set up all of these stages that they can listen to the voice of the students themselves and help and support them and actually do something about it.
And do you think more schools now and companies, from what you've heard through your clients and perhaps just speaking to organizations, do you feel like people are actually putting a mental health practitioner in place for the students and dancers?
A lot of them are bringing in mental health practitioners, but unfortunately, mental health practitioners don't necessarily understand dancers. One of the questions I ask is, have you had previous counselling or psychotherapy? And some of them will say yes, and then the next question is, did it help? Now, invariably, they say no, because they didn't understand me. So this client goes and has counselling for anxiety. And the counsellor says, oh, perhaps dancing is not the profession that you need to go into.
Yeah.
So it's getting a better understanding of dancers that is needed. So not putting a counsellor, just putting a counsellor in a school or a company is not necessarily the answer. The counsellor has to understand dancers.
Mm-hmm. I remember once being, I had a stress fracture, and once it had healed, I was speaking with a consultant about it. And I said, you know, like, what should I do going forward? And he said, well, I mean, like, well, obviously you need to quit ballet. I was like,
yeah. Well, I can tell you a similar story to that. I mean, this is in 1968 when I joined the Royal Ballet. I pulled a muscle, that's right, and I needed to go on that evening. And in those days, we didn't have rest. You went to an osteopath or whoever, and you were on in the evening. That was it. So there was no rest at all. So this is where you get the old story of, if I can do it, so can you do it. You know, the old school. Anyway. So they brought in a physiotherapist, and in those days they weren't trained to deal with athletes and dancers, etc. And she said to me, what's wrong? Well, I told her, and she said, well, how did you do it? And I showed her, and she said, why did you do that?
Yeah.
She had no concept of what a dancer has to do. And so I think in exactly the same way that mental health therapists now, in general, do not have a concept of what dancers go through. So that's why there's training for them is needed.
With the improved awareness of the body and nutrition towards, like basically applying sports science to dancers, you know, we've seen dancers be able to achieve amazing physical things with their bodies now. You know, like if you take the dancers from 50, 60 years ago, they wouldn't be on stage right now. No shade to them, but that's just, you know, there's been huge advances.
No, you're right. So, when I see dancers nowadays, you know, I was never like that.
No, me neither. But if we applied mental health to dancers in the same way, what would we be capable of?
Well, there would be a longevity in a career to start with. There'd be a totally different mindset. There won't be that fear of, FOMO, fear of missing out, fear of not being cast, fear of not moving forward in their career at all. It's a true fear because of the regime in some of the schools and some of the dance companies. I'm saying not all, because I know of dance companies and of whom I'm working input with, and also vocational schools, again, who I'm working with, to be able to alleviate that fear.
Dancing Without Fear.
Yes. Oh, this is a title for a book, isn't it?
There you go, Terry.
Yes, there's my next book.
That was Terry Hyde talking to me about some of his insights on our ballet and mental health survey. If you're interested in his work or getting in touch with him, go to his website, counselingfordancers.com. Link in the show notes. So this is the end of our two-part episode on ballet and mental health. Before we get to the five takeaway points from the survey, an attempt at putting something constructive forward, I'd like to reintroduce my co-host for this episode, Zoe Ashbrown.
Hi again, everyone. Gosh, it's so great to get Terry's insights like that and to be able to speak to someone in our industry that has the understanding of both sides of this conversation so intimately. It's just invaluable advice and it's really, really hopeful. It's hopeful dialogue.
Zoe, what has been your personal reaction to the response we got from the survey?
Well, for me, the take home, like I say, is definitely a sense of hope. You know, I was really reluctant to approach you, Emma, about mental health and dance because I think it's such a, it's a minefield. It really is. And it's such a layered conversation. And I also understand the challenges in finding a resolution. I understand why people would maybe listen to what we have to say and think, you know, well, how can we maintain the art form and still move forward in this progressive way? You know, a lot of classical training, at the root of it, you have to surrender a certain sense of individualism at a very young age, but also maintain a sense of self at the same time. And I think that's where a lot of the issues can stem from. And, you know, our industry and our job, it's very similar to being in the military or the Marines, something like this. And so I completely and totally understand why people are scared to have this conversation, because we don't know what it will do to our art form. But speaking to Terry and, you know, this last thing that he said about dancers dancing without fear, I really have hope that this could be an innovation for our art form, that rather than taking steps back and compromising on, you know, quality and excellence to protect people, I think, you know, if we get this connection of mind, body and spirit, this really could be the start of something really exciting for our art form. And, you know, for the people that have already been through classical training and the people that so generously contributed to our survey and told their very, very personal stories about what it was like for them as a young person, for these people, I hope that this conversation can give their experience more meaning, you know, because people are so willing to share their experience in the hope that something can change. Mm-hmm. And I think after talking to Terry and after sharing all of these experiences, I feel really confident that it can change.
So let's get to our conclusions. Here are five takeaway points based on the responses to our survey for schools and companies.
Number one, communication. In the studio, one survey taker asked for better language around corrections and being treated more respectfully. Remember, as a teacher or coach, you are in a position of power, and what you say and how you say it can severely impact dancers' self-confidence. Outside the studio, encourage dancers to have a voice in company meetings or student union.
Number two, mental health support for dancers from an individual trained to work with dancers, or at least athletes. In our survey, when asked what would improve the mental health of classically trained dancers, this was the most requested thing. And it goes for companies and freelancers equally. That includes ballet staff too. It's good to remember many of them are ex-dancers. I realize there are financial restrictions to fulfilling this, particularly for small companies. But at the very least, we can introduce a work schedule that allows for life outside the studio, understanding if a dancer needs to take a day off for their mental health, or perhaps resources to read or support group.
Number three, an open acknowledgement from ballet companies and schools that they are dealing with power structures that are open to misuse. A commitment to professionalism is needed from directors and staff, perhaps like a code of conduct. This goes for guest stagers, teachers, and choreographers who come into the studios.
Number four, body image. This is a big one. Acceptance of different body shapes and sizes within ballet. As Terry said, we need to get away from the quote, nymph look. It's inhumane. Apart from attitude changes, there should also be available advice from nutritionists and sports scientists. And as Shelby Williams told me when I was interviewing her for the first part of this episode, physical correction should be comments on technique. That's it.
Number 5, extra training for staff that enables them to better manage the different individuals in front of them in a studio space. This could be about spotting mental health problems or sensitivity training for race and gender issues. After all, dancers need to constantly update their craft. So it'd be wonderful if the artistic management was also developing with the dancers.
I think it's good to point out that I have not interviewed anyone who runs a professional ballet school or company for this episode. I acknowledge that many institutions are improving and have already thought and enacted many of the suggestions we have just made. But I think it's pretty obvious we can still do better. In the survey, we have people who have graduated less than 5 years ago or currently working in a company, and they're talking about the same things that happened 20, 30 years ago. These are persistent problems. That said, I invite anyone running a vocational ballet school or company to get in touch. Our email is in the show notes. Maybe there's even a part 3 to this episode in the works. Thanks to Zoe, all of our interviewees, but most of all, thanks to the hundreds of you who filled out the survey. And please know that we read every comment, thought about them, absorbed them. If you're in pain, please know that you are not alone. So many of you echoed each other in your comments. Let's make this better. Let's do better for the next generation. Okay, closing credits. This mini-series for Mover Shakers Makers is supported using public funding by the National Lottery through Arts Council England. It has also been a Makeshift Company production. Follow us on Instagram at Makeshift Company and check out our website, makeshiftcompany.com, where there is a link to the podcast website for show notes. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you rate and review the show, it would be most appreciated. Thanks for listening.